Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy. Buckle up because we're going to have a lot of fun today. Part of that fun is telling you about the Buzz Index, because if you've ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all of that online chatter about social media and investments, well, guess what? Your wait's over, because those artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, those are now at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. It's called the Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund, trades under ticker symbol BUZ, and it gives investors like you and I a basket of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. They don't do surveys. They don't guess. You've seen how surveys can be slanted. Guessing obviously doesn't work. Instead, Buzz targets the most mentioned large cap U.S. stocks that have the most buzz online. For more about how it works, head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and to their Buzz newsletter. That's moneytreepodcast.com/Buzz. I'm happy today that I get to speak with certified financial planner and CPA Greg Sullivan. He's the president and CEO of Sullivan, Burnett, Spiros, and Blaney. They just call it SBS&B. They're a wealth advisory firm in the Washington, D.C. area. Barron's, by the way, has recognized Greg as one of the nation's top 100 independent financial advisors, and Washingtonian Magazine named him as one of the best financial advisors in Washington, D.C. So I'm very happy I got to speak with Greg. So let's go now to my interview with Greg Sullivan. And joining us on the Money Tree Podcast, Greg Sullivan. Greg, how are you, man?
Joe, thanks for having me on. Look forward to being here.
Well, let's talk about this, because in some ways, when I first picked up the book, I thought you were the Grim Reaper, right? You talk about all these ways people fail in retirement. Why a book on retirement failures?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because some people look at the title and they think it's intimidating. And hopefully other people, the people really take a look at it and they think it's intriguing. So it's more supposed to be intriguing, because no one wants to fail. And the whole point about it is all these people do all this great work. They plan, they save, and then they hit a bump and something actually happens. The whole purpose of the book is to say, hey, be aware of these things. Events happen in life, or we do things in life that causes us to trip up. And I just want experiences mainly for awareness. And then you have deeper conversation, so that if those events come about, then you can plan for it and have a successful retirement and not one that that causes failure.
Yeah, when I first picked up the book, and you, of course, being a certified financial planner, I thought this was going to be about problems with asset allocation or the technical stuff. But really, Greg, it's not the technical stuff that throws people. It's these life events that throw people.
That's exactly what I'm trying to talk about. So it's more about the emotional events or life events than it is, you know, did you invest your money properly, or did you, were you invested in stocks or bonds, things of that nature. It's the other items, personal items, emotional items, and some family items that come about that actually become the trip up points.
Let's talk about some of those things that you go over. Let's start with your first story in the book is these people. In fact, I'm going to read just from the beginning of chapter one, Greg. You say, I was talking to a client who was living the good life in Florida. Julia owned a beautiful penthouse condominium, drove a sporty car, traveled frequently with friends, and wore ultra stylish clothing. This sounds like the good life so far. Looking at her, you would have thought everything in her life was going well. Underneath the surface, however, lay the nagging question of whether Julia's assets could support her extravagant lifestyle forever. It seems, Greg, that a lot of people, this reminds me of so many people, they get to retirement and they think, okay, it's party time. I can now spend money the way I've always wanted to. And that might not be the case.
Yeah. And you know what we hear about these cases, you even read about them, you know, when you read about, you know, sports people or movie stars or things like that who had great income, but then that career ends and now they have to live off of what they've created. They have to live off of what they've saved. So there's a difference. I actually have a story around lakes and rivers. I don't have it in the book, but this is what I talk to people about. So when you're making money and you have income flowing in, it's kind of like a river. It's constant and it's always coming through, and you have fresh water coming through all the time. But when you retire or possibly get divorced or your career ends, you're sitting there with a lake. And so the question is once you have that lake, how well can you preserve it to make sure that you have enough for your lifestyle? So what happens is we see people that they just continue to spend as though they have endless amounts of money, but they don't have endless amounts of money. They have a finite amount. And so they have to stop and look at their cash flow and their lifestyle around what they have created. It's hard, especially in this case, you know, with Julia, the case, it's a divorce. So she was used to having endless amounts of money. They had a good income. They had good sources coming in. And now they're sitting there saying, she's there saying, well, I'm going to continue to live the lifestyle I've always lived. And we're saying, you know what? The pool isn't big enough. The lake isn't big enough for you to continue at this pace.
How do you broach that subject with somebody like Julia? Because I'm sure the first thing your client does, Greg, is they get pretty defensive, I would imagine.
Oh, they do. It's a hard thing to talk about. And that's the importance of the book, is so that when you create awareness, then you realize maybe I'm not alone. Other people are in the same situation. And so with that, you know, maybe I can have that conversation. So that's what we start with. I just say, hey, look, you know what? You're not alone in this situation. We've seen it before, but now let's just show you what happens and let's help deal with it. Rarely do they stop and say, oh, thank you so much for sharing that with me. You don't need to necessarily just turn everything upside down, but you need to start making incremental changes.
Let's talk about some of those incremental changes, Greg, that you see people make. What do you start with? Do you start with the number they can live on and then sit with them while they cut this, cut that other thing? What do you see people do?
Yeah, so we use actually some computer modeling to help our clients to see it. And we just start playing what if games. All right, what if you sold that second home that maybe you're only using periodically, and maybe we took that money and did something better with it? Each person's different. Each situation is a little bit different. And we try to identify that for the client. But just recognize, hey, cash flow, when you no longer have a steady income coming in, is really, really important.
I don't want to get too technical today, but you have in the first chapter, you have a funnel showing growth assets and income assets. And those income assets, it says funds needed over the next 8 years. And then the top of the funnel says growth assets. Can you explain that to me, like how that funnel works so that somebody in retirement can keep the lifestyle they want?
Yeah. So we create portfolios based off of your cash needs. A lot of times people say, oh, you know, your portfolio should be organized based off of how old you are. I don't think that's relevant. Your portfolio is based on what kind of income you need from your portfolio. So, for example, if you need $100,000 a year of income from your portfolio, we would then recommend that we have 8 years or $800,000 sitting in lower risk income-based assets. Could be municipal bonds or corporate bonds or CDs, things of that nature. And the reason we do 8 years is we want to know that your portfolio will not be disrupted by other assets that may be more growth-oriented, such as stocks or real estate, but they also can be either harder to sell or they go through tough times. We saw that significantly in 2008. If you're going through 2008, you did not want to have to sell at a bad time. And so what we do is we build 8 years of cash needs in our client portfolios so that any market cycle, they can weather the storm and you'll come through it. And we've seen this over and over. And that's why I say it shouldn't be the portfolio that causes a retirement fail. It's all the other things. If you build your portfolio off of my funnel concept, you won't be disrupted and you won't have a retirement fail. I've used it for 35 years. It works. It's a process that if you can stick to it, that won't be your disruptor.
And let's talk about another disruptor. I have twins that are 23, and this next chapter scared the hell out of me, Greg, and it's the nest that won't empty.
Yeah. So actually, this was probably the most favorite chapter. I had two favorite chapters I wrote. One was the nest that won't empty. And I love it because I have two children as well. Now they're older. My son is 31 and my daughter's 29. You know, I experienced the same things I write about. Matter of fact, I write several stories about my children in this chapter, but also about looking at other families. And it's, you know, more and more children are relying on their parents and parents are enabling their children. The point we're trying to get at is create awareness around really what's the right way, what's the right mix in helping your children through tough times, or what's the wrong thing to do when you actually create enablement. the situations we end up talking about, I've got a great story in there where the child calls up the parents and says, you know what, hey, I would really need help with my children's private school tuition. And the mom's calling me up and say, hey, we need to get the money and let's help them out. Like, okay, this child is an attorney making very good money, living in a nice home, actually has a second home, and they're coming to their parents needing help for tuition. So they're living above their means only because they know mom and dad will come to the rescue.
And mom and dad may be struggling because of it, but the kid doesn't understand. What do you do then, Greg? Do you share with the kids? Is this intergenerational planning where we then share with the kids mom and dad's situation, like they can't afford to help you? Or how do we set the boundary?
Yeah, sometimes we do. Well, I'll ask the client. I said, do you mind if I talk to your child and let's have a conversation? And let me see if I can help them recognize your situation and that we don't have endless amounts of money, that maybe they need to step up and do some things themselves. In one client situation, a different situation, I actually asked the child, I said, would you be comfortable with your mom and dad moving in and living with you? Yeah, they're like, oh, yeah, no, I don't think that's really what we're intending. I said, well, if you keep wanting to put pressure on them and if your other siblings want to put pressure on them, then someone's going to take them on. And they got the picture, and so they backed off. They do it because they want to maintain their children's love. And I'm like, well, you know what? I think you still will maintain your children's love, even if you show a little tough love.
It's funny the number of times, Greg, you end up playing psychologist with people is what I'm hearing over and over.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so much emotional and psychological aspect around money with your children, with your own personal cash needs, with your spouse or partner. Just imagine all the interactions and the emotional, psychological issues that go on. Not all bad, but what happens is oftentimes people don't want to talk about the issues. And that's what we're trying to do. With the book, we create more awareness around more of the issues that people can stop and look at and say, okay, let's talk about them.
You've tips at the end of every chapter. I like this idea with kids, make gifts random in both amount and timing so kids don't feel entitled to them or come to rely on the cash. Just mix it up a little bit there. I'm going to skip a chapter on divorce. I mean, divorce is definitely wreaks havoc on things. I want to talk specifically about something later in the book, Greg, which is healthcare. Obviously, this comes for people out of left field. You and I have both seen over the years long-term care costs go through the roof. Long-term care policies not doing what a lot of times actuaries thought they'd do in the late 90s. What are you guys doing now to address long-term care scenarios when the options just seem more dire all the time and there's fewer options for people?
Yeah, that's a real challenge, and it's a challenge for families. But again, what people need to do is stop and say, let's not put our heads in the sand and assume it won't happen or that we won't need it. Let's actually stop and take a look, because if that's going to come along, are you really financially prepared for it? A lot of people don't look at it until the event occurs. And we're like, no. We need to be looking at this now when you're in your 50s or you're in your 60s and not when you're in 70s or 80s, stop and say, oh, now maybe I need to do something about it. Because there are ways to protect and prepare for it. Long-term care policies, they're much harder. They're much more expensive, as you just indicated. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be still looking at them. But we also can look at other vehicles that will help support. And maybe when you're aware of those things, you're not going to be so generous with thinking you're going to give your money away to your children or buying second homes that may not be quite financially affordable, things like that. Maybe you have to rethink some of those issues, preparing that you might need some long-term care coverage.
When you talk about some of those other ways to handle it, I'd love to hear that, Greg, because I think people think, you know, people look at long-term care policies and they say, well, I can't afford that, so I'm not going to buy any, thinking that now it's over. And to your point, just because you decide not to do something doesn't mean that you're not going to have a catastrophic illness. What are some of the other ways that you've seen clients and help clients prepare for that?
A couple of things. One, and really where the real challenge ends up being, is when one spouse needs long-term care and the other spouse does not. That becomes the more difficult, because a lot of times what we're doing with the long-term care is we're selling the home, taking the proceeds, using that to help us get into a long-term care facility, get additional support. But when one spouse is still living in the home and the other one needs to go into a facility, now they're really in trouble. So now they really have to turn and look to other resources. So you have resources, you know, from your savings. You have resources from changing your lifestyle and preparing for it. And that's the hardest one. We actually start creating a what we call a long-term care account for clients, which is a, you know, it's just like a separate bucket. Say, hey, this is going to most likely happen, or we have to be prepared for this over the next 10 years. We're going to set up a separate account, recognizing that here's what the expenses will be, and you help them to see that. And then you have, you're taking a look at what type of insurance they have set up, health insurance and other kind of coverage that they have. And we stop to say, what's the right way to put your package together for your special needs? So it's really just, it takes a planning process. First, it takes awareness and a good conversation around the issues. And then you need a planning process to help out.
Clients in retirement sometimes get a little bored and they're so used to working. They come to you and they say, hey, Greg, thinking about starting a business. Love your chapter about that. I'm surprised you have hair because I'd be pulling my hair out if my client goes, I'm going to start a restaurant and I know nothing. What do you say then?
You know what? It's an interesting chapter because I think people don't really want to talk about this issue very much either. And what the issue is around their identity. What we see happening is when people retire or they get preparing for retirement, they're like, okay, well, I used to be an attorney or I used to be a corporate executive or I used to do this or that. That's who they are. And then they come home and after a few months, you know, they're staring themselves in the mirror and saying, you know what? I need to go do something. I need to still be somebody because I want – they don't call it identity. They just call it more about, hey, here's what I want. I really want to go do this. But a lot of it's around their identity. And so we try to have that open conversation as well. But when they go down the path to be an entrepreneur, they start coffee shops or they might start a restaurant. Or the real interesting one is when they decide to help their child start a business.
Oh, no.
Oh, whenever I see those happening, I just like, oh, my, come on in. We need to have a conversation on this one.
My parents actually did that with my brother, and my brother went through a lot of my parents' retirement money. My dad happy to help, but what frustrated me, Greg, and probably what frustrates you is when you're helping a kid with a business, you're handing the money off and you're not in control of your own destiny anymore. Now you got to trust that your kid's going to do the right thing with your assets instead of you relying on yourself.
Oh, absolutely. And why do we help the child out? Not because they're necessarily great at business, not necessarily because their idea is terrific or they're really made to be a great entrepreneur. We help them out just because we love them and we want to support them and we're not doing it for any other great reason. And I see it over and over. So what I try to do in those cases, I said, okay, you want to help them, but let's put a boundary around how much you're going to help them. And let's be honest and transparent of what that's going to be. And so if you set the dollar limit and you say to the child, hey, this is all I'm going to be able to provide you because my retirement or other financial issues. Sometimes I say to them, I said, you know what? What about the other siblings? Like in your case, what about the other siblings when it doesn't work or if it doesn't work? Do you adjust what the inheritance will be for the other children? Or should we create a loan agreement or some other ways to which we want to take a look at it? Because it then creates other tension inside the family.
Yep. Yeah, it's
there's created, a lot that goes on with that.
It's created lots of tension in our family, actually. And it's funny, we all get along, but there's this underlying tension that my brother went through a lot of their money. And on the surface, we're all fine. But every once in a while, usually after a couple beers, it kind of boils up and makes Thanksgiving not as fun as it was, you know, before that. So,
but it's a big issue. The identity issue and figuring out what you're going to do is a big one, whether or not you help a child or I've seen clients who, you know what, they were successful at XYZ company, big corporation. They were very successful. Then they're retired or they decide they're going to go try something out on their own, but they're really not made to be a CEO or an entrepreneur. They were really better serving inside a big corporation. And they go off on these tangents and they go try to build these businesses that takes a lot of capital, and the spouse is supporting it or their partner is supporting it. And then literally it could be hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars that go down this path before they realize they have to just call it quits.
What if it is a good idea though, Greg? Let's say it's a good idea. You think that the client's going to knock it out of the park. How do you advise them to set up a business? Like I'm sure your goal isn't to crush people's entrepreneurial dream. How do you put boundaries on them or help them put boundaries on this idea?
Yeah. So in those cases, I'll actually be happy to sit down with them if they come to us before they get the venture started. Sometimes they don't. They start the venture and then come and tell us. But if it's in advance, we have a game plan. I actually lay it out in the book of the key things that you need to be able to do as a CEO of the company and what I call the five P's. Here's how you build your business plan. And so I say, let's build this business plan. Let's follow these five P's, which is around purpose, people, process, profits, and pricing. And so you build around those five items and we'll build a solid game plan. Now you have an idea of what the capital is required, how you're going to build it. And let's truly build a business plan that's thoughtful, not one that's like, I have it on the back of an envelope and I think I have a good idea. There's a lot of great ideas that fail because they weren't thought out and you didn't have a business plan. But there's also, you know, ways in which you can stop and look at it and say, you know what, this might just be more than I can, you know, I'm biting off more than I can chew.
That's what I was thinking. Is that there's lots of great ideas out there. It's more about execution. As you're talking, the first thing I'm thinking is it's all about executing on it. In the book, you also go over buying a second home and tell people how to go about it. If you're going to buy the second home, how to do it, when not to do it, underliving your wealth, life's unpredictabilities, not getting swindled, and then at the end, how to hire a financial advisor. And you've got a checklist there of all the things people should ask a financial advisor and how to look for one. Where do people get the book, Greg?
Well, it's available everywhere. Amazon.com, Audible Books, which is, it's awesome. The guy they have reading the book is really great to listen to. It's not me reading it, but he's a pro. It's a great read. It's a great one to listen to. But it's on Walmart and eBooks. It's pretty much available everywhere.
It's called Retirement Fail, The 9 Reasons People Flunk Post-Work Life and How to Ace Your Own. Greg, thanks for hanging out and talking with us a little bit about it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks again to Greg for speaking with us today. And we're about to introduce you again to our gang of contributors. The way our podcast works is the first half, we talk to a great guy like Greg, and then we talk to great people that I'm about to introduce to you if you're new to the show, and we'll talk about the same issues Greg and I discussed earlier. But first, have you ever wondered if there was a way to capitalize on all of that online chatter, the millions of investors out there on social media? Well, guess what? Your wait's over, because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques that some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds use, and those are at your fingertips, making your edge their edge. The Buzz Index is licensed to an exchange-traded fund that trades under ticker symbol BUZ, and it gives investors like you and I a basket of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. There aren't any surveys. They don't guess. Instead, Buzz targets the most mentioned large company U.S. stocks across the social media landscape, all of them. It doesn't matter who's talking about it. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability becomes of the buzz. And then each of those most mentioned stocks goes in and gets an insight score from Buzz's proprietary analytics. And the 75 stocks that have been talked about the most positively, those then get included in the index. Each month, the Buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, and the 75 companies with the most bullish score, those get selected each month, positioning Buzz to capture the highest return potential. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/buzz. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index to sign up for the free Buzz newsletter to kick the tires and see how it works and more information. By the way, I invest in the Buzz Index. Doesn't make it right for you, but I needed to disclose that before we get to our panel today. And let's say hello to the gang. We'll start off in the great state of Idaho, where my friend Miranda Marquit sits. Miranda, what's happening?
Not a lot. Just excited to be here. Excited to talk about financial choices, as always.
Yes, you're all about the choices.
I really am. I'm really all about the choices and the priorities.
Let's talk about somebody else whose priority was to be here with us today, Linda P. Jones.
Hey, Joe. How you doing?
I'm fantastic. And you're in the desert now, right?
Yes.
And it's, 127 degrees?
About 108 for the next 60, 70 days, something like that.
Making like 60, 75 seconds of sunbathing. Fantastic.
Exactly.
Right. And a guy who's in a different desert nearly halfway across the world, my friend Doug Goldstein.
How you doing there, Joe? Yeah, regards from Israel. I think that your priorities, by the way, depend a lot on the time of day. Like in the morning, your priorities get into the coffee machine. And,
right.
You know, by about this time of day, it's getting to be a panelist on the Money Tree Investment Podcast.
Right, which is wild for 4 a.m. that's your priority. But yeah, that's great. Let's talk about this. I love talking to Greg about the fails because I love this idea that people think a lot about the portfolio. The portfolio is where the problems are. And Greg says, no, it's kind of these dumb decisions you've made. Linda, have you seen that in your life, people around you that have retired, that it was more the decision-making than the problems of the portfolio?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, he made the point about you retire and you think, oh, you can just spend like crazy and everything's the good life and all of that. And people don't think about how long they're going to live and medical expenses, how expensive that gets at end of life. I mean, there's this big, huge bill that comes right at the end of your life. And people forget about that. So I think he was right on. And your discussion with him was right on, talking about being conscious about the fact that there may not be more money flowing in, or depending on where your money's invested, that's going to dramatically affect how much money you have coming in. And it's important to have that river and have renewable income coming in, even in retirement, especially in retirement.
Doug, turning to you for a second, one thing I see certified financial planners talking a lot about that I don't see the popular press talking about a lot is this idea Linda brought up of longevity, right? Longevity is a huge issue, and I feel like nobody's really giving it its due.
Yeah, I think that is a very big issue, because let's say that someone retires at 60, 65, 70. You know, it used to be like when Social Security was first invented, you would start getting it at age 62, although I think the average life expectancy was 60. So you had no chance of getting it. And now people who are living into their 60s are likely going to be living into their 80s or 90s, or, you know, if you take your vitamin D, you could even live longer. That's no guarantee in past performance. There's no guarantee of future returns. I think that when you're planning for longevity, it means that you really may have to worry that the value of your portfolio is not going to grow. And it's really unfortunate, because that means that as you're getting older, you might still need to have money in the stock market. The question is, how much risk can you yourself stand emotionally? And secondly, is how much risk can your portfolio really stand? And that's why it's such a tricky decision. I've actually heard people even say that when you retire, you should start increasing the amount of money that you have in your stock portfolio, which is counter to what everyone else says, because they say, no, you got to decrease it because, you know, you're getting old and what happens if the market crashes? There are a lot of different philosophies on this, and it's not always obvious which one is correct.
Sticking with you for a second, Greg talked about this idea about having 8 years, and he references his 35 years working with clients, that you have 8 years in kind of an income position to get by anything that might go wrong in the market, like 2008, 2001, 2002, that time frame. Do you agree with the 8-year idea?
Yeah, I like to say that. In other words, I'd always like to be able to say, oh, problems are contained. And by the way, sometimes it's just literally a matter of months, you know, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. But the fact is, if you look at the markets over time, there have been, well, shall we say, great depressions that lasted much longer than that, that people were really, really up a creek for a long time. And that's why when we talk to someone about an emergency fund, you know, a lot of times people say, well, you should have 3 to 6 months worth of liquidity in an emergency fund. Depending on a situation, people might literally need years worth of money in short-term safe investments.
Miranda, I want to widen this, because with your work at adulting.tv, you know, you talk about the other side of this. Greg's talking about retirement, but I'm thinking, as I think about what you do, you talk about these same exact issues. These aren't just retirement issues, right? Spending too much money on your kids, affording more house than you think you could get, healthcare, you know, he talked about long-term care, but healthcare in general being too much. Like, these issues he talked about really aren't just for retirement, they're for everybody.
Yeah, you can run into these problems no matter what stage of your life you're in. And that's kind of the issue here, right? I mean, you never know what's going to happen. You never know what issues you're going to run into. And you have to be ready for these kinds of problems no matter where you're at.
He talked about early on about this idea of overspending, and specifically for him in retirement. But you and I both know people that are just blowing money that they don't have.
Oh gosh, yes. I was one of them once.
well, how do you change, right? I mean, we talked about him being an advisor, helping somebody change, but on your own, if you're listening to this and you go, oh my God, that's me, how do you change?
One of the things, and I know I sound like a broken record because I do talk about this a lot, almost as much as I talk about indexing. I think one of the big things is understanding your values. So many of us don't take a step back to say, oh, well, what really matters to me? What matters most to me? Because one day, basically, I was looking around and I was going, my goodness, why do I have all these trinkets? Why do I have all this stuff? It's not bringing me any joy. It's not bringing me any happiness. It's not helping me reach any of these goals. I say I want to go travel and I want to do these things, but you know, I am living in an apartment that's slightly more than I can really afford because it's nice. And my then husband and I are paying car payments on two cars when we really only need one. You know, none of this is going with the values that I have. None of this is reflecting the things I want in my life, but I'm just doing them. And so for me, really, it was taking a step back and saying, okay, what do I really value? What's really important to me? And how is my spending not reflecting what I say I want? And then taking a step back and saying, okay, now I need to adjust things so that my financial resources are going to the things that actually matter and are going to the things that are working toward my goals. And it's not something that happens overnight. And it's not something that, oh, well, all of a sudden now I'm spending smart. So now I have vast riches to do whatever I wish with. That's not how it works. It's a process and it takes time. But once you start there, once you start saying, okay, what really matters? What are my values? How can I bring my use of money in line with those? Then you can start making those changes.
It's funny, Linda, as I'm listening to Miranda talk and she's talking about choices, one of the things Greg talked about was this idea of a second home. And we have he talks about this client who sees a second house that they really like and they have to move quickly, right? How do you process when you think the goal might change and now you want this second home that before wasn't one of your key life things that Miranda's referencing?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. First of all, we've gotten into this habit of buying things that we can't really afford. Or, you know, in the old days when my mother was young, she would save money before she would buy something. You know, that was the habit, is to save and then pay cash and buy it. Today, people go out and, you know, get a mortgage that maybe they're maxed out on, or a second mortgage they're maxed out on, or buy a second home that is really going to stress them. But they do it because there's credit available. And a lot of what's going on right now is a function of credit being very inexpensive. And when the cost of money is so low, it causes people to just spend it without really thinking about it. But now that interest rates are going up and that cost of money is rising, it's becoming more and more expensive, and that debt really, you know, weighs on them. So I think you really do need to know what your priorities are, what you really want out of life, and match those priorities with where you're going. And I, you know, Miranda and I completely agree on this. And I talk about having five specific spending priorities that you really know you want your money to go to. And seeing something that you just are impulsive, you know, that's what people do at auctions, or that's what people do, you know, they get themselves into trouble when they spend impulsively. But when you really sit down and think about what is it that we're trying to accomplish, what is it we really want to do, and you have that plan, that's when you can stay on track and really stay focused.
I felt like sometimes, Doug, that Greg comes across as the Grinch, right? You can't have this. You can't have that. And I can just imagine you, Doug, sitting across the table from a client going, nope, too rich. Nope, too expensive. How do you have those conversations without being the doom and gloom dude?
I'll tell you what's interesting is that although I do occasionally have those conversations, and I'll tell you about a funny one in a second, it's more often than not the opposite. where I will meet with people who are older and retired and they've saved and they're getting some pensions and they're so afraid to spend any money that they need me to cajole them to go on a vacation or to join a group or even literally buy a book on their Kindle because like, well, you know, it's $10. And I'm thinking, yeah, but you have $4.5 million. It's okay for you to spend the $10 on this. Maybe they grew up at a time when they didn't have a lot of money, which is common. And they've always been careful, which might be one of the reasons that they actually now do have a lot of money. But, you know, I point out to them that you don't get a prize for dying rich. You have to enjoy your life. And it's not necessarily buying things. It could be buying experiences, which I think is more important. Spending time with the kids and the family, taking trips, doing things together. But I find more often than not, I'm dealing on that side of the equation. From time to time, I'll meet a client who's just an insane spender. I've spoken to people who inherited sometimes millions of dollars. Now, when we look at those accounts, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they just cannot stop themselves. And I bring them in or I try to bring them in. And they're like, they're so afraid to talk to me that when they call the office, they'll speak to my secretary and say, hi, could you wire money to the account? And then she says, well, you know, you got to sell something first. I'll have to let you speak to Doug. And they go, oh no. Okay, forget it. So, you know, it's their money, right? They get to choose what to do with it. But there are some people that you just can't help, I think.
Miranda, where are the biggest places you see that people could probably cut and make the most difference in their lifestyle?
I think that goes back to, once again, where are your values, right? I mean, people would look at me and say, well, geez, Miranda, you could travel a lot less. Yeah, I could, but I'm not going to. But I think it depends, you know, you start with your values and say, okay, what matters to you? So I like to use my ex-husband and myself as a good example. We're on good terms. We just have different priorities, right? He is a things person. He really likes having a big TV. And there is nothing wrong with that because he enjoys watching the TV. He uses the TV. He likes collecting action figures. There's nothing wrong with that. He likes having them there. He looks at them. That fulfills him. He enjoys it. I like to travel. I like to see different things and I like to do different, you know, see new places and meet new people. Those are kinds of different approaches. And so for somebody like me, if I am spending money on trinkets and tchotchkes and, you know, a TV, like I barely, like a year and a half ago, barely bought a 50-inch TV. I had a 32-inch TV for 10 years and people thought I was insane because I didn't have this big TV and I bought it. It came on sale because it's an older model and they were trying to clear it out. And so I finally bought a 50-inch TV. Meanwhile, there are people that have 72-inch TVs and that's fine if that's what's important to them. So really it's all about looking at what's important to you. A lot of the time the impulse purchases are going to be your problem. Like what Linda was talking about, not thinking about what's going into your shopping cart. 34% of what we buy is impulse, right? So that's like, that's a little more than a third of what you're putting in your cart is stuff you didn't plan to buy. And it's stuff that isn't helping you reach your goals.
Imagine if we changed that, Miranda, where 34% of our decisions to save more money were impulse.
Exactly.
Like, oh, I just got to save more cash 34% of the time. How much better off would we be?
So yeah, I was speaking with Carl Richards once, the guy that wrote The Behavior Gap. And he talked about before you put something in your shopping cart or before you make a purchase, pause and say, oh, that's interesting. And look at it and ask why you're making that purchase. And I think if you did that one thing and looked at what you're buying or what you're spending your money on and say, does this meet my values? Does this help me accomplish my goals? Is this really going to enhance my life? If you stopped and said that, there'd be a lot of things you'd do different.
Mine would be, oh, Bluebell ice cream. Why not more?
For reals, right? Is it helping you enjoy your life more? I say go for it. As long as you're not going in debt for it.
I never stop eating that stuff till I'm full of shame, right? Linda, Greg talks about entrepreneurship, and I think I want to dive into that. Entrepreneurship when you're in your retirement years, dangerous?
It definitely can be. I mean, we know that the statistics aren't good for businesses. Most businesses fail. And so people want to make sure that they are well prepared to start a business. Now, I think it's easier than ever to make a business succeed these days because the cost of having a business has come way down. And because of the internet and just doing things online and being able to hire contract workers and not employees and, you know, lots of things like that. But I think it still is prudent to probably have a side hustle before you give up the full-time job and try this endeavor on the side. see if it works. Or if you are very experienced in a certain career, maybe you were, you know, in the electronics industry or something, and you can be a consultant and you know that you have relationships already in that field where they're going to hire you, then you've minimized your risk. And so anything you can do to minimize your risk before becoming an entrepreneur, I think is really important, because the last thing you want to do is take your life savings and have that all be for naught and be older and not have an opportunity to recreate that money. So you want to be very careful with taking that as an investment and becoming an entrepreneur. But having said that, I am very encouraged that entrepreneurship is an incredible wealth building tool today.
I love that idea though, Linda, of kind of testing the concept first. Like, you know, like most companies will do anyway before they market a new product line. Test the concept, make sure that your love is as deep as you thought it was.
That's right. And a lot of people are starting side hustles and are very, very successful at their side hustles. I mean, we see that all the time in the financial community and in other online, you know, blogs and other online endeavors. It's amazing what people are doing as a side hustle and their part-time, and then it becomes their full-time, not only a full-time business, but also a better income earner than they were making working for someone else.
Doug, this idea he talked about long-term care, obviously long-term care prices going up, like he and I talked about, the deal is much different than people thought it was in the late 90s. A lot of companies getting out of that. How do you address long-term care with your clients?
I think it's very important for people to really consider their own situation and find insurance that's going to work for them. Unfortunately, it's not always possible, and sometimes it's very, very expensive, in which case you're going to have to do some level of self-insurance. As a general rule with all sorts of insurance, I encourage people that if they can afford it, try to choose the insurance with the highest deductible so that you're not paying so much in regular premiums on that insurance policy. What ends up happening is that people find these policies are so expensive because they're always paying the premiums, whereas they could have afforded the few thousand dollars up front as the deductible before they needed some sort of major care. But unfortunately, it is a very, very difficult situation. But I would just warn people, as we see from the politics of it, it's a really harsh situation out there. And at the end of the day, you really can't count on anyone else other than yourself. And that's where your own savings and your own insurance policies come in.
Widening this discussion a little bit, Miranda, you're an entrepreneur. You then have to buy your own healthcare. What are some of the tricks you use on a wider, not long-term care, but just wider affording healthcare?
Yeah, so I actually don't have to buy my own healthcare anymore, which is great. It's a beautiful new revolution.
Cool.
Yeah, this whole paycheck thing. It kind of sucks to be a corporate sellout on one end, but on the other end, I still basically do what I did before, only now I get paid twice a month and I have healthcare. So yay. But no, back when I was an entrepreneur, I mean, really, the only thing you can do is shop around. There are some places you can go, like you might be able to find an industry organization. So for writers, right, they've got the Freelancers Union, or you can go to a place like Media Bistro and they offer you access to group health insurance plans. So that's one way to save some money. So check with your industry group. So if you're an entrepreneur, you belong to a certain industry, look at some of those professional industry groups, see if it's worth joining, see if they have group insurance policies as part of their perks of joining. You will have to pay for those, but you can get a little bit of a discount. Another thing I did that actually worked out well for me when I first moved to Idaho is I actually did go on the healthcare exchange and did get an Affordable Care Act plan. The way things are going right now with the efforts to claw that back and kind of dismantle the Affordable Care Act plans, I don't know if that's going to be a real possibility in the future, but I did find personally for me that I was able to find some affordable plans using the health insurance exchange. So that helped as well. So kind of look in those two places to see if you can get a little bit of a savings.
Awesome. Fantastic. I think we'll end it there. And Miranda, we'll stick with you. What's happening at Planting Money Seeds at adulting.tv about everywhere that you write?
Yeah, it's just go check it out. I would really love to say I've got plans, but it's summer. I'm working on a presentation about outsourcing your life to earn more money and live your best life by paying other people to do things for you. So I assume that once Ignite Podcast Movement is over, I'll be able to share that with everybody in the various places that I am. So yeah, head over to plantingmoneyseeds.com, adulting.tv. And of course, you can always check me out on Twitter at M Marquit.
Awesome. And Linda, Loved hanging out with you again. What's going on over at Be Wealthy and Smart?
Well, we've got a podcast about 5 reasons to become a good saver. I talk a lot about wealth building. I don't always talk about the saving side of that. So, Doug, you're going to be happy to hear I did a whole podcast about being a good saver and the reasons to become a good saver. Check that out at Be Wealthy and Smart.
That's fantastic. Mr. Goldstein, what's happening with you at Goldstein & Gelt?
Indeed, we did a show very recently called How to Achieve Financial Success, really meant for people who live outside the U.S. who have U.S. brokerage accounts. That would be Americans and non-Americans who invest in the U.S. because I'd gotten a listener letter where from a guy who lived outside the U.S. and his broker in the States told him, I'm sorry, I can't give you advice anymore. So the guy didn't know what to do. And that's how he came to me. And we speak about that and give people a great takeaway called 3 Steps to Financial Success. And that's all at GoldsteinOnGelt.com. And you should listen to that, of course, right before you listen to Joe Saul Sehi. Joe, what's going on at Money in the Morning?
Money in the Morning, 5 days a week, headlines that we rip from the recent press. And if there's something hot, we'll take it from that day. So 5 days a week, a quick 20-minute podcast. And if you want to join in, by the way, the podcasting fun, you can do one of 2 things. You can either join us in our Facebook group, the StackyBenjamins.com/basement. You go there and it'll give you a link to our Facebook group, or you can email me headlines that you want me to tackle if there's something you don't understand. And that's where we do it. So that's going to do it for us, kids. Thanks for hanging out. And Miranda, you've got it from here.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and everywhere else fine podcasts are sold. That way you will get a new episode every Friday morning. It'll sneak in there overnight. And when you wake up, you'll get a fresh steaming pile of something. Oh, well, it's usually talk about investing. So join us every Friday morning. And don't forget to head over to moneytreepodcast.com for all of our archived episodes, new resources, and information about our panelists and our sponsor, Buzz Indexes. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.